Support our programming at patreon.com/rebelforceradio. Become a patron, and your contributions can help unlock bonus shows from RFR, online hangouts with the Rebel Force Radio crew, and more. Say it loud and say it proud. Support Rebel Force Radio. Click on the Patreon banner at rebelforceradio.com or visit patreon.com/rebelforceradio.
Rebel Force Radio is brought to you in part by Little Debbie Snacks, bakers of all galactic goodness, like mini donuts, Star Crunch, cosmic cupcakes, cosmic brownies, nutty bars, and much more. Little Debbie, official snack of Rebel Force Radio and fans around the galaxy. From Topps comes the all-new digital card collecting app, Star Wars Card Trader. For the first time ever, collect and trade everything from legendary 1977 Star Wars cards to new cards featuring exclusive content, all from the comfort of your mobile device. Star Wars Card Trader. These are the cards you're looking for.
Rebel Force Radio presents...
This is Master Obi-Wan Kenobi. I regret to report that both our Jedi Order and the Republic have fallen.
This is Star Wars Rebels, Declassified.
I like the sound of that.
A roundtable discussion about Star Wars Rebels.
Pretty gutsy move, kid.
I am the Inquisitor.
We're busted.
Chopper, get us out of here.
Now it's time for Star Wars Rebels Declassified.
I just want to say that if Star Wars Rebels itself can take a break here and there, why can't Rebels Declassified? Right? We can take a break, but we're back. We're back, and we've got a triple header this week. We're going to be looking at the last three episodes, including just this past week's episode, and that incredible two-parter about the Darksaber. Legacy of Mandalore. That's what wrapped it up. But we'll also be talking about what preceded it, Trials of the Darksaber and Warhead. Breaking it all down for you here on this exciting, brand new episode of Rebels Declassified. And I'm so glad we've got just a really cozy group of folks to do that with us. Starting with my good friend and yours from Chicago, Jimmy Mack.
Hey, Jason. Hey, Star Wars fans. Cozy. Yes, come on, let's cuddle up and talk about Star Wars. That sounded weird. But no, really,
not
I am.
To
I'm,
me.
I'm
happy. Maybe that makes well, me weird.
You know, but I am happy to be back here, finally getting caught up here on Rebels. Definitely some monumental moments happening and some questions I have about specifically about these Darksaber episodes. But all in all, real compelling stuff. And looking forward to talking about it this week on Star Wars Rebels Declassified.
I am as well. And what makes this probably even more exciting is the fact that we also have with us our good buddy, our brother in the force from across the pond, Mr. Paul Bateman.
Paul. Hey, guys. Hello, everybody. Nice to be back. Been a long time since I've done one of these.
I know, ages too ages. Long. Too long. Well, you know, a lot of it has to do with the fact, just to pull back the curtain just a smidge, is really the time difference. It's never us not wanting to have Paul on the show, because we do hear from people through email on social media, when are you going to have Paul on, where Paul? And so Jim and I, we actually record pretty late. And so when it's pretty late for us, it's really late, like in the middle of the night for Paul.
Oh, yeah. So I get like, oh, how are you fixed for like starting at 4 o'clock in the morning? I'm like, oh. How do you feel about talking about Rebels at 4 a.m.?
And you're a night owl anyway, so you're probably hitting, you know, you're not going to bed till probably 1, 2 in the morning. And then, you know, you can't set that alarm for just 2 hours. And you also have a wife
well,
to think
I could,
about.
But I think like, yeah, Athena would punch me in the face if I did that. She'd be like, I'm sorry, darling, I have to get up to talk about Rebels.
Which that would get her really well. Would make a really great episode. This episode, hey, remember the episode when Athena punched Paul right in the face?
It could happen.
It could. But let's get to it. We've got three episodes to talk through. And I'll be quite honest, the first one, you know, I watched it a couple of times and thought, okay, that was interesting. I certainly, it didn't bore me. It felt, but I didn't feel like it really lent itself to much conversation. So, but we'll see. We'll see what the other folks have to say. Of course, I'm talking about Warhead, episode 14 here, season 3, written by Gary Whitta, a name very familiar to all of us. One of the original story writers on Rogue One. In fact, actually gave Rogue One its title, I believe, is the story. and directed by Bosco Ng. And so this is a very Zeb-heavy episode. Not only Zeb, but also AP-5. And, you know, one of the things that's sort of a hallmark of Star Wars are sort of the echoes and the reprises that we see. And I don't know, do you guys think that AP-5 and Chopper are an echo or a reprise of R2 and 3PO?
Yeah, and I like the fact that Chopper may have a counterpart that can actually, number one, translate what he's saying, serving the same role 3PO did, but also serving as an occasional foil. I think that's great. And it's a proven formula that works in Star Wars. We're seeing something similar in the Darth Vader comic series, or the now the Dr. Aphra series from Marvel, where you have a protocol droid and an R2 unit, but they're both sinister. And it just plays. It's just one of those things that works. It's a Star Wars archetype that fits the stories and stuff. I haven't seen them go too over the top with it here in Rebels. A lot of times you would find that sort of chemistry between Zeb and Chopper would be similar to that of 3PO and R2 at times. But now to have them be joined with a proper droid counterpart, and one that sounds like Alan Rickman, which is cool. You have a Professor Snape sounding droid, courtesy of Stephen Stanton. But I think it's all right. I don't know. What do you think, Paul?
I think it's interesting that you say you sound like Alan Rickman. I mean, I think he does. I mean, I actually think he sounds like Alan Rickman doing Marvin the Paranoid Android in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Okay. That's what he sounds like. If you listen to him, you know, oh, you know, really? I've got to go to the car park. You know, he sounds like really kind of annoyed. Annoyed by everything, you know. I mean, I often watch Rebels and don't really make a strong connection to it. But this one for me was I was just sitting kind of, you know, watching these three episodes back to back, and it was peculiar. Although Rebels is full of Macquarie influences, you know, obviously, you know, they've spoken about it a lot, you know. It was one of those episodes where I just kind of sat there and thought, that droid's Ralphie, that droid's a Ralphie, that droid's also by Ralph. And then and before I knew it, I was like, yeah, almost everything in this episode, Ralph kind of, you know, was inspired by a sketch that Ralph came up with, you know. And for a time there, you know, depending on what planet they're on and what have you, you know, they get the colour just right. It's really kind of, I don't know, it feels like a really comfortable place to be for me. So although, you know, I could see that people could kind of see this first episode and kind of think maybe it's a little A to B, not like part of the big story arc and what have you, you know, for me, I really enjoyed it. It felt like, I don't know, it felt like home to me, you know, it felt like familiar and comfortable. I liked the fact that, I feel like Rebels, you know, when it's working at its best, it's almost trying to do something very different from Clone Wars. I mean, I've not been very quiet about the fact that I much prefer Clone Wars. I think in large part just because of the scope that show was able to have, you know. And I know that a lot of people kind of, you know, enjoy Rebels more because of the intimacy and the kind of the way that the characters are unfolding, and we're not kind of scattered. We're kind of concentrating on the key players and stuff like that. And for me, I kind of feel that this show really works at its best when it kind of keeps things kind of concise and small and intimate. And this was one of those episodes where I kind of felt like it's not trying too hard. It's just kind of a simple story. And, you know, it feels like Star Wars, and the humor I felt really, really worked and what have you, when the new droid turned up and the whole thing, like, wait, what, Rebel base, you know, and all that. That made me laugh. And so, yeah, I mean, I kind of felt like it was not something that people will write about for years, but it felt like a really tight little story, and it ticked a lot of boxes for me. It kind of, it made me laugh, and then I enjoyed the kind of, you know, just the rocking kind of adventure side of it too. So I thought it was a good app. But
a huge trademark of the Star Wars Rebel series is the influence of Ralph McQuarrie, specifically taking direct lifts of his design. Now, the droid, the protocol droid that was that landed in that Imperial pod on Adelon, he is obviously a direct copy of Ralph's original design for C-3PO. At least it's derivative of that. Yeah,
it's actually a weird hybrid, because I was looking at it kind of, when I looked at it really closely, like in high def, I was looking at it kind of going, well, it it's, you know, the main sort of look and shape of the thing is lifted straight from, you know, some of Ralph's earlier 3PO concepts. But the way it's finished and stuff actually feels like quite a lot like his Asimov covers. Like Ralph did a ton of Isaac Asimov book cover illustrations for like Robot Dreams and Robot Visions and stuff like that. And there's a lot more kind of just like kind of line work, you know, like where 3PO, you tend to get a little business. There's a lot of mechanical components. There's a lot of functionality at the joints and things like that. But like the stuff that Ralph did for the Asimov books is very clean and very slick, you know, and it just has these like pencil lines all over it and what have you. And it's not sort of uber complicated. And so for me, it felt like a cross between his Asimov stuff and his 3PO stuff.
But, oh, interesting. Interesting. But, of course, you can see pictures of all that stuff in the great book, The Art of Ralph McQuarrie from Dreams and Visions Press, where they have all of those paperback covers, the Isaac Asimov stuff, all that stuff's in there. And you'll see what Paul's talking about. But, you know, I thought for sure there was going to be the opportunity to tie in to Rogue One a little bit with this episode.
Yeah.
And when the pod opened up, out would pop a K2SO droid. But I think maybe that's a little bit too on the nose, and you don't want to be confusing people. Like, oh, it's K2SO, and it turns out it's just an Imperial
droid.
It's funny,
Jim, you say that, because Dave Filoni actually went on record on Rebels Recon and said that he regrets not having that be a K2 droid. That had he known when that episode would have aired at the time they were creating it, he would have gone a step further. Now, he didn't say he would. He said he would have made him more of a hybrid between the two to show some, you know, obviously some evolution. But I got to tell you, this notion of evolution is really bugging me a little bit. I mean, we're 2 years out at this point from Rebels. And I don't know about you, but my iPhone pretty much looks the same as the one 2 years ago, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
this
obsession that the creators, that the designers seem to have of, well, we can't have it be really an AT-AT because this is 3 months before, so it's going to be an AT-ART or whatever. I mean, make it a damned AT-AT, would you?
I know specifically what was going on there, because the designer of that AT-AT, or one of the designers of that AT-AT, was the guy that designed the, obviously it was a team effort, but I know one of the guys who worked, I can't remember his name, but who worked on the Princess Leia's ship from The Force Awakens, is a big Space 1999 fan, and he kind of admitted as much that Leia's ship was highly kind of inspired by that. And if you look at the early concepts, it's got like these red and white stripes on like what's known as a rescue eagle from the old 70s show Space 1999, and that was his favorite starship as a kid. And one of the things about the Space 1999 eagle was that they were kind of modular, and they had this like a lot of Gerry Anderson shows like Thunderbirds and things like that. They have a tendency to sort of like have a pot, like a what would you call it, like a crate or whatever in the middle of the ship that it kind of clamps onto, so that they can kind of change it and swap it out and make it all kinds of different things. And for me, as soon as I saw that walker, I was like, yeah, this is just somebody having a Gerry Anderson kick. Where
well,
it's like
I saw your post, Paul, on Facebook, where you were, we've got our first glimpse of the stormtroopers in The Last Jedi, and you're like, in that beautiful Paul way, you're like, looks like the mouth is a little more narrow there at the bottom, you know, something. And I'm like, oh, good night, nurse. Now we've got, wait a minute, this, we've got evolution.
Is that it?
Now?
I was going to ask Paul, though, what are the differences in the trooper designs from The Last Jedi when you compare them to The Force Awakens?
All I could see was like there's a narrowing, like, you know, like if you look at the mouth on the original stormtroopers, it kind of tapers down and it just looks like a little pointy kind of downward facing mouth. And then you look at the stormtroopers in The Force Awakens, obviously you've got a line that goes all the way around to the eye, and it's almost like the kind of markings on a cheetah or something like that. And the line is kind of, it's an equal width, the full length of the line. It's kind of a difficult thing to describe, but in the Last Jedi, it kind of is going back to that kind of like pointy sort of shape. So it's still kind of connected up like in a long line, but it's really, really narrow at the sides. So it has a feel of the old troopers more than the Force Awakens ones did. But I mean, I kind of see that. I can imagine that how they're probably going to justify that is that the, you know, that the New Order is probably you know, moving towards the Empire rather than moving away from it. You know, it's not like the Empire evolving. It's kind of almost going backwards. So who knows? Maybe the troopers will get even more like original Stormtroopers by the time we get to episode 9. But I mean, it's a tiny little change, and I'm sure it's just something that maybe, you know, Gareth preferred, or sorry, not Gareth, Rian Johnson preferred or something. But it is strange that, you know, as far as I can tell, there's really only one kind of significant alteration. I'm sure most people won't even notice. But I think, you know, it's something we're all kind of comfortable though with, really, though, Jason, because, I mean, when it boils down to it, I mean, every single Star Wars movie we've ever seen, you know, right from the very start, you know, the pattern they got into pretty quickly with Empire was, oh, we've got a new movie, but have some new troopers out there so the kids can kind of get a kick out of it. And I think that's still true. I think, like, I still look forward to seeing new Stormtroopers every Star Wars movie. I kind of expect them, you know, as much as you expect like a giant monster in a space battle. You know, you kind of think like they've got to be.
I can see the Hasbro commercials, you know, right now, where you got the kids in the 70s clothes and it's like, bring home the galaxy of the Last Jedi. Oh, wow. My new Stormtrooper has a narrower mouth feature. Cool.
This will filter out all the toxins on, you know, for sure. This is great. Yeah. And can you imagine sitting at Bob Iger's desk at the end of the month when he's going through all the expenses, like, why did we order 250 Stormtrooper helmets? Don't we just have them left over from The Force Awakens?
Yeah.
Thinner mouth?
Think of the figures, dude. Think of the figures.
That's right. Figures. By the way, speaking of action figures, as we record this, we're in the midst of New York Toy Fair 2017. A big announcement from Hasbro. Yes, we've heard you, and we're still working on that Force Awakens Luke figure. There's an update. It's still a work in progress. I don't want to give up any surprises.
I heard they showed something. They showed something, but no photos allowed. What are they trying to hide here? I mean, we all know what Luke looks like. Why no photos? Why even bring it out in front of the media if you're not going to let people take pictures of it? And Hasbro, why are you giving up on the 3¾-inch line? And all the collectors have supported that line for 40 years. What gives?
Well, I do want to say, let me just throw in my one little bit of conspiracy. I think they learned the hard way with that 6-inch A New Hope Leia, that they put that photo out and everybody said, but her face looks like a dog's butt. Oh, yeah. And it's dreadful. And when you see the thing and then they said, OK, we'll retool it before it hits production, which was absolutely not true. I have it and I can tell you it does look like a dog's behind.
Well, but there's a whole history of Hasbro not being able to supply collectors with a suitable Princess Leia.
But my theory, though, Jim, is that the reaction to that, what you're talking about is they do it at Toy Fair supposedly have a sculpt of the Force Awakens Luke figure. My hunch is that people were not excited about it. Keep in mind, this is coming out after that incredible Hot Toys piece made the rounds. And so the pressure is on Hasbro. I think if they had really something to show that the fans and the vendors in attendance were excited about, we'd be seeing it. But the fact that we're not tells me that they've got miles to go.
I wonder if it has something to do with Mark's appearance, you know, because, I mean, as much as he lost a lot of weight and stuff like that, you know, he's still, you know, I guess his look is would probably take a few people by surprise that haven't, you know, been paying attention to him like we have as fans, you know, where you kind of go, well, there's Mark, you know. But if you get sort of maybe casual fans who haven't necessarily seen Mark since the 80s, you know, that maybe they had reservations about, you know, the look of the character or you know, just the change, you know, since people have kind of seen it. But for me, you're just going to think whatever the excuse, none of it makes sense. Because and all the issues regarding production and stuff, you know, when you kind of look at all these, you know, smaller companies that are able to kind of like get stuff. I mean, to be literal about it, like there's, I could go to, there's a shop in central London that supplies sculpting materials for the film industry. I could literally get on a train tomorrow, go and get the materials, have the figure sculpted in 3 days, even though it's not what I do, and have it in a mold by the end of like the month. And I'm like an amateur who doesn't really know anything about it. How is a toy company that's like one of the largest toy companies in the world not able to get such a pivotal, important character like out and on shelves in time for the movie? I mean, whatever the politics or like, we should have
at
it by
rate,
now.
We'll be
sure.
Excited. I mean, at this rate, we'll be happy to get it out by episode 8.
That's right.
Yeah, right. I mean, like, I just don't. Has anybody heard?
2 years it's taken them and two Star Wars movies to make this figure.
Has anybody heard a good enough reason where they think, like, well, that makes sense? You know, because I just haven't heard anything where I think, oh, well, of course. You know,
nothing,
that makes perfect
sense. There really hasn't. There really hasn't been. There's got to be some sort of internal politics or something going on. But at least I'm heartened. But, Jim, I agree with you. As much as I am a fan of the 6-inch Black series, I really am. But I certainly have loyalty to the 3 3/4 inch, and that is really there's very little to report, I think, so far out of Toy Fair 2017 on the 3 3/4. All the big 40th anniversary stuff is happening to the Black Series 6-inch line.
Are they the ones that are getting the vintage style packaging?
Yeah, it's the 6-inch. Yeah,
it's still ugly. Like, it still needs to go back to what it was. It's not.
It's not quite still there. Ugly. Yeah, no, it's not quite there.
It's off balance and stuff. It's like. Just, you know, like it was, it's like they just have to accept the fact that it's like Rolls Royce, you know, like, okay, you can redesign it so it's better, but it's still not a Phantom. You know, it's you have to, it was a classic, you know?
Yeah. All right, here, let's talk a little bit more about Warhead. one of the things that we learn is that this is, you know, these infiltrator droids being sent out across the galaxy or in a certain area where Thrawn has sort of limited his search for Sato's rebels. This is what we understand a pretty this is kind of an off the books operation. Those infiltrator droids have been banned by the Empire, which that right there tells you something, right? Yeah. Why are these things banned? Like, this is even too extreme for the Emperor. This is a guy who's building a weapon that can literally blow up a planet, but this droid that can maybe take out a base is like, oh no, that's, what do you think I am, crazy? That was a little Hamill Joker instead.
That was very Joker.
But very anyway, good. But my point being, it was just a little odd plot point there that I thought was interesting. But
can I provide some? Can I provide?
Would you please,
some insight?
Jim. Yes.
Okay. I think the bottom line is they're far too dangerous to be used for two reasons. Number one, it will fire up that self-destruct sequence just like that. And it's equipped with a proton warhead. So if it's going to have that sort of artificial intelligence that tells it to turn on the proton warhead, really just for no, you know, I mean, because it seems too volatile. Mm. The other reason is it's very easy to reprogram these things, as we see in this episode.
Right.
They're very easy to reprogram. If Zeb can do it, I think just about anyone can. So they can be reprogrammed and used against the Empire, and they destroy a Star Destroyer with it in this episode. That's probably not the first time this has happened.
Well, it was kind of odd to me because, you know, you think that Thrawn is the type of villain that he's using a scalpel where everyone else is using a machete, right? He's the strategic nature of him. So this seemed a little haphazard, though it did, at the end of the day, it did provide him with a much better guess as to where the rebel base is. So, you know,
that's kind of predictable when you consider how this season has been unraveling. How many episodes have we ended it with Thrawn saying, oh no, this is not a failure, this is not a loss, this is a victory. I mean, it happens every time he's on screen in an episode. You know the episode is going to end that way. It's becoming a little predictable, I think.
Yeah, Thrawn is actually a great PR spinner, right? I mean, when you think about it, like, Thrawn needs to be, you know, a press secretary. He can spin anything. Oh no! This is all part of the plan.
Yeah.
Oh, thank God he doesn't have a Twitter account.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Oh my God! Someone needs to create that. If it's not already done. So
you know it is now. Well, somebody will be doing it right this second, won't they?
Right. So once again, you know, the rebels seem to win the day, but Thrawn's going to win the war. And I think the one thing that we see here towards the end is that the circle, the noose, maybe we should say, is tightening a little bit more around Callus's neck. Just every time they get closer and closer to finding the rebels, I think Callus becomes more vulnerable in his betrayal of the Empire as Fulcrum. So I think that's kind of what I left this episode thinking about, was more, you know, it was entertaining, but it didn't really lead me to anywhere that I wasn't before. And I think that's what I sort of expect from Star Wars and Star Wars storytelling. And I get somewhat frustrated when I don't feel that I've left an episode, you know, knowing more than I did before about the overall story. And Paul, you made the statement, and you've been very consistent about saying that you felt that you loved the scope of Clone Wars. It was this big galaxy, this big universe. And one of the things that I feel like I've loved about Rebels was the opposite, the fact that it was more intimate. You kind of had, you know, sort of this, God, I hate to use Star Trek as an example, but you had this crew, you know, and you were following their adventures, and they would come into contact with maybe some of these more establishment characters in the Star Wars universe, but it was always about them. And I just feel like they just keep picking up more characters and more characters and more characters. And then you have a character like Kanan that's just getting the complete shaft. And we're going to get into the next couple episodes and where Kanan's there. I just don't feel like he's really there. It's just like Kanan now is there to serve the other characters and not himself.
For sure. I mean, I feel as though this is something that we've had an issue with since the Clone Wars days. You know, I mean, I remember joking many, many years ago about the fact that, you know, we had Yoda in episode one of the Clone Wars and we basically had nothing to do with him till right at the very end. You know, so we had like essentially six seasons where they were quite happy to do a three-parter about a frog we didn't know. But Yoda could just be completely abandoned, you know. And I think like with many of these characters, the feeling that I'm left with from the Clone Wars days is like, you know, when Clone Wars finished, I really missed Kenobi almost immediately. I kind of went, I wanted more of that kind of Kenobi Anakin relationship, and I kind of feel that I'm gonna get a similar feeling with this. I mean, I kind of feel as though many of the characters have a lot of potential. They have a lot of, you know, there's a lot of possibilities inherent in just, you know, the fact that they've come up with, you know, a Jedi that hasn't quite completed his training and a Mandalorian that's kind of like young. It all has a lot of potential to be kind of, you know, interesting and engaging. But I don't feel like they ever quite get us there. I kind of feel like they just kind of dance around it a little bit. And it's a tall order, I have to say, to tell the kinds of stories that they tell in 20 minutes. And it never feels that short to me. It always feels like it's much, much longer. And they do a great job of kind of managing to kind of engage us in a story that feels like Star Wars by and large most of the time. But I kind of feel like a lot of the character development is very slow, you know, or never gets there at all, you know. And for me, like I feel that when I really make a connection with the character, it's normally after like a handful of episodes that really dig deep into a character, and that doesn't happen very often, you know. I feel as though we almost get right to the end of somebody's journey, and it's like they kind of go, oh no, we haven't developed the character. Quick, let's tell everybody everything we can about the character, and have them kind of, you know, like understand more about who they are and their backstory and stuff like that.
You know,
and
that seems to be a problem in general with television these days, Paul. And I mean, these days, it's been that way for probably decades, actually, where it's just... Well,
there are other shows that have no character development at all. I mean, you know, right. Like, so it feels unfair to criticize it, but it's like, you know, I think if people love a character because they've already just personally kind of invested in it, then those episodes are great. But I think if you're just not that connected to a character, then, you know, it often feels like a little too late, you know?
Yes. And but, which will take us into the next episode.
Absolutely. Trials of the Darksaber, the first part in a two-part arc about Sabine and the reemergence of the Darksaber, which is a symbol of the consolidation of power by the House of Ren. Not the House of Ren, the House of Isla. It's the Ren family, the House of Isla. And we talked a lot about this during the Clone Wars about, you know, I struggle with the whole kind of, it's very sophisticated. I'm not criticizing it, but I struggle with the whole hierarchy and the way that the Mandalorian culture is divided up. And for you Mando freaks out there, and I say that with love, I don't mean that in a bad way, You love this stuff, and that's great. And I'm glad that the whole Mandalorian culture has been canonically fleshed out for you. But anyway, I struggle a bit. But this is episode 15 of season 3, and written by Dave Filoni. And I want to throw this out because this sort of, well, we should say directed by Stuart Lee. Dave talks about in the Rebels Recon, he wanted to write this episode because he wanted the whole thing to be about the training. He wanted the whole episode to take place over the course of the training of Sabine and learn things along the way, but never to disrupt this notion of training. Jim, why do you think, looking at this episode, the training was so important to Dave that that not just be, you know, one scene, that it really be the whole episode?
It's almost as if it's a statement saying that people can be trained in the Jedi arts without having any Force abilities. It's almost like that's sort of the mission of this this whole training sequence. I don't believe that really Kanan gets any growth out of this training. He takes a lot of abuse from her, actually, yeah. Sabine.
Yeah.
And Ezra, it doesn't appear Ezra gets anything. I mean, it all comes together at the end when they profess their love for Sabine. They say, we'll stand by you because we're your family. And, you know, despite the fact that she has been basically exiled from her own family, which is, we learn all of this in this episode. Finally, we learn what Sabine has been hiding from everyone all this time. And, you know, when she does reveal it, is it okay if I just jump right to it?
Please, go ahead.
She reveals the reason she's been on the run, the reason she's so miserable all the time, is because she was she was brought into the Empire to help develop weapons, which they ended up using against the Mandalorian people. Yet Sabine spoke out about this, and when she did so, her family turned their back on her, and then she split because she had nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. So I guess, I mean, but why is that the big secret? Why did she have to keep that a secret? Was it maybe to protect her family? Is that why she had to keep that to herself all these years? I don't see what she's
Where's the shame, right? It was almost like there was something you were going to hopefully find out. Where's the shame? Could that, though, be, Jim, that we'd have to almost be Mandalorian to know, right?
Well, I hate that as an excuse. I hear you. And I deal with some things too, you know, personally speaking, where people will hold back and they won't reveal things to me out of fear of being embarrassed, out of fear of exposing something else and everything, when I'm there to lend a friendly ear and maybe help support and provide guidance. This happens to all of us, so we all know what it's like. But I felt a little disappointed in the final revelation of Sabine's big secret. I felt like there'd be something more. I thought she'd have more blood on her hands. Obviously, we know that the Empire makes people do what they want them to do, whether they believe in it or not. We know that as a fact.
Right.
And it's something that she actually should have exposed and used as propaganda to use against the Empire once she became part of the organized rebellion. And so I'm looking for all of these things to be revealed in this big confession she makes. And it just, at the end, leaves me a little bit
I also got to say,
unsatisfied.
This character has done a lot of living in her 16 years or 17 years. Yes,
yeah, we've spoken about that, too. But that all does kind of come together a little bit.
Oh, you know, she was in the Academy, the Imperial Academy. She's building, you know, revolutionary top secret black ops weapons for the Empire.
That part I don't get. What does she mean? She built weapons for the Empire. Was she actually like a mastermind like Galen Erso, or was she just working on the assembly line and decided to speak up?
We do know that she went to sort of, I think there was an episode where they were talking about her history and she went to sort of the equivalent of like an MIT or, you know, I mean, like she is top notch brain, picked probably at a young age. Probably has some, you know, genius qualities in terms of weaponry or technology, and they turn it into, you know, focus her on weaponry. Paul, weigh in here about this. Maybe we're are we being too critical?
Well, I just kind of feel as though it's to echo what you did, Jason, and touch on Star Trek slightly. But like example I would give is like you know in one of the last Star Trek movies, Into Darkness, much knocked. One of the things that kind of like everybody had a hard time with was the fact that they were kind of trading on like older characters, kind of kudos. So you had like. You had a scene which everybody remembered from Wrath of Khan where you've got Spock dying and Kirk is, you know, full of pain and he screams Khan and all this. And it's a big dramatic death scene. And then when they tried to kind of like echo that, but in reverse in this remake, basically like it, none of the characters had really earned that level of kind of emotion. So it fell a bit flat and it just kind of felt odd. And for me, Sabine, I mean, I've been watching this show religiously from the start. I couldn't tell you a damn thing about Sabine and who she is. I really just don't care about the character. And I do care a little bit about some of the others. Like Hera, for me, is much more engaging and more interesting. She feels like a more developed character. But Sabine, it's like she just does, she's just really, to me, she's just a character that hasn't been developed properly yet. So to suddenly take it to a place where we're meant to have this big emotional scene, I'm just not in the right place to really kind of get a kick out of it. And I feel like the performance was excellent and I felt like the writing was clearly very strong, but I just feel like the preparation was so not there that when this landed on us, it felt premature. It was like, well, really, I'm supposed to care about this? I don't really, you know, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. a performance is great and everything and the dialogue's fantastic and I get it. But like, I mean, like 20 minutes earlier, I really couldn't have told you anything about her, you know? Yeah. So it's like, whatever. So, yeah. Which sounds deeply cynical, I'm very sorry to be so down on it because this show is full of like, you know, creative stuff that I just kind of think is exceptional. I mean, it's so much ahead of its peers in terms of, you know, you compare this to any of the kids' show that's out there at the minute, and it's exceptional. Mm-hmm. But you know, Star Wars is one of these things where we do, you know, to a certain extent, expect it to have a standard that's way above everything else because that's the way we kind of look at it. You know, and I have expectations that are probably deeply unrealistic, you know, from Star Wars because it's such a big deal to me. So for me to have a character like this have this big kind of dramatic emotional scene like and it have it fall flat, I kind of feel like, oh right, there's something wrong there, you know. So
I feel like they laid so much track, but you know, for Ezra and Kanan that this shift just seems to be odd. And I know they don't want to make it just about, you know, the Jedi Padawan. They wanted to branch out and all of that, but I definitely agree that it's not that the character, you know, by virtue of who she is undeserving of this importance. I feel it's the way that I feel like, yeah, I know that's not what you're saying.
I want it to be developed, you know.
Right.
I want it to be developed.
But I feel like that the character yet, in the way it has been developed, hasn't earned quite this stature that she's being given here. And I struggle with that a little bit. It just seems like, it's like, well, why am I supposed to care? Because she's Sabine. Well, why am I supposed to care about Sabine?
Right.
Because she's cool. You know?
But is she? I mean, here's my issues with Sabine are primarily.
Is she? Yeah.
My issues with her primarily have to do with her overall attitude and outlook on life. And these episodes really, really amplify this fact that she's very short-tempered. She's sarcastic. She's mean. She's arrogant. She's a bully. She's constantly threatening Ezra. The first thing she does when she gets the Darksaber is lunge at him. She's demeaning. She tells Ezra to shut up.
I think she's immature. I think she's really immature.
She is very immature. Yeah. She calls Kanan a lousy teacher. She's such a know-it-all. She wants to fail. She beats herself up all the time. I'm a traitor. Never wants to come clean, talk about what the real issues are. Always running away from her problems, always running away from reality. She can't get along with her own family, her real one, or her extended family. She's always the victim.
But we're supposed to love her.
But we're supposed to love her, and she's a great role model. I don't get that. But here's the thing. Here's the thing with Sabine. I'm looking for serious character growth. I think that they were amplifying all of these negative qualities about her in this episode to illustrate how far she grows by the end of this two-part arc. So let's pay attention to that as we move along and discover if there actually are these moments of growth for Sabine, or if she is still the same short-tempered, snarky, sarcastic, mean person she is at the beginning of the episode.
Well, there was a little go ahead, Paul. Go.
I mean, I kind of feel like, you know, one of the best developed characters in this show, despite the fact that she's, you know, she's only really had a handful of episodes dedicated to her, you know, like is Hera. I find her a very likable character, and I find what she's about very interesting and engaging, because I find the character kind of like interesting and hard to categorize, and you know, she's a lot of things at once, you know, whereas Sabine just kind of feels like the cool kid. You know, but that to me is as far as it goes. And I mean, I know that there are lots of Sabine fans out there, so I'm sorry that this character is not kind of connecting with me. And maybe it's because I'm not a young kid, you know, but I just kind of think that this character could be a lot more than it is presently. And I think like Star Wars generally has characters that are actually quite rich, you know, I mean, like at least, you know, Han has a side to him that's not immediately apparent. So does Luke, you know, I mean, you don't really realize that he could actually be the hero of the universe at the very start. He just seems like a kind of a whiny kid, you know. Mm. And I know it's all about that journey, but I just kind of think by season 3, is it we're in now? I think that, you know, I kind of feel like even at 20 minutes a pop, we should kind of, you know, I'm expecting to kind of feel more for this character than I do. And I'm not really sure why that can be, other than the fact that they just haven't developed her. I mean, yeah. maybe other people feel differently about it. But
personally, I'm getting there. But I don't think that our observations are so off base, because I think they're somewhat reflected in Kanan. You know, he kind of sees this.
Yeah.
He's the guy that sees her as, you know, to all those things that Jimmy Mack was saying. And he didn't want to put a blade in her hand, certainly not a lightsaber blade. I mean, he said, look, I'm not putting energy, or I'm not putting a blade in her hand. I'm putting energy in her hand. Mm. But I do.
But again, you know what?
Yeah.
To sort of underline the thing I was saying earlier about how the whole training of Sabine is kind of a way of saying, well, you can train people in the Jedi arts, even if they're not force sensitive. It takes me to that conversation Hera has with Kanan, where she calls him out saying, you didn't train Ezra with a stick. Is this because she doesn't have the force? That's what she says to him. And I'm yelling at the TV. Well, yeah. Did you just hand her a lightsaber? You have to have a connection with the force. So I don't get what the message is here. Are they really trying to say, no, you have to let that go? People who aren't strong with the force can be trained. We've obviously seen, going back to the original trilogy, Han Solo used a lightsaber.
It's an allegory, because they want to say that Kanan was treating her differently because she's a girl. That's what I think it is. I think that was the Star Wars equivalent. Yes, I really do. And I'm glad that they sort of dropped that a little bit, because if they would have kept beating that up, you know, I half expected her to say, you knew that for Ezra because he's a boy and I'm a girl. And I thought, oh, geez. But I'll tell you what I do love, where this resolved real quick, Paul, I'll just say where it resolved was, it brought Star Wars back to where we all believed, those days when we all believed that we had the ability within us to be the next Luke Skywalker. And it had nothing to do with midichlorians, and it had nothing to do with any of this. It had to do with her connecting to the force that binds the galaxy together, that lives in all living things. And even Sabine, despite all of her negative qualities, still started becoming one with the energy of that blade. And that was a fist pump moment for me, because it, again, brought back this notion, and Jim, you said it very eloquently before, about the force being something we can all tap into.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And thank you for saying I was eloquent. it must be the coffee.
I kind of feel as though, like, one of the things that I have to kind of compliment them on is something that folks might not be aware of is, you know, I did martial arts for many years. I did Kung Fu for going on sort of nearly 20 years. And I've done an awful lot of sword work in films and stuff like that. So I've used all kinds of swords, from katanas to foils to Chinese butterfly blades and all kinds of weird stuff. So sword work always kind of gets my attention when it shows up in Star Wars because I'm just into it, you know. And one of the things that you do find when you kind of get into the martial arts in a big way, certainly the Chinese martial arts, is that quite often the opening kind of period of somebody's training is about taking the aggression out of them. And I felt like they really kind of communicated that fast, which was basically kind of, you know, she's got that angsty kind of aggressive way. And a lot of people are attracted to, you know, the kind of combat arts or fighting arts of any kind, you know, they go into it quite often with quite an aggressive attitude. You know, that's just what is appealing to them about it is the fact that that's an aspect of it. And I think that the first part of everybody's training in so many arts is about just kind of getting that out of them. And so to me that felt super, super authentic, you know, the idea that she would need to shake that off because she's a fighter, and to fight really well she's got to have a head about her, she's got to fight without anger, as Luke would say, you know, and she's got to kind of get level and sorted out. And so for me that all felt very authentic. And I mean, I know that one of the most enjoyable experiences I ever had as a like, you know, when I was very passionately into Kung Fu, was watching a young woman kind of go up against this great big guy, and she kicked him to kingdom come. And it was you realized it was basically because she was smarter. She just had better tactics, and she had a clearer head, and she was less emotional, and she just totally dominated in that sort of situation. And to me, it feels like that's what they're doing with Sabine. They're taking her to a place where she's, you know, she's the one that's in more control than the next person. She's the person that's got her wits about her the most, and she's the person that has the most skill that's not kind of, you know, messed up and kind of cluttered by emotion and stuff like that. So for me, that aspect of it was actually quite charming, and it was quite nice to watch. And I kind of feel like, well, it would be interesting to see Sabine go from like this character that's moody and, you know, sort of touchy and aggressive, and take her somewhere that's much more kind of like laid back and focused and controlled. Because I actually don't think we get a lot of that from any of the other characters. I mean, Kanan is actually quite aggressive for a Jedi. I mean, he loses his temper quite a lot. You know, where you think like, hey, that was a bit aggressive. You know, I mean, he loses his temper with Sabine in this one. Mm-hmm. And by rights, you would think like, okay, you know, if he'd had enough training, that wouldn't happen. You would think that he'd keep his calm no matter what. I mean, because that is kind of Jedi lesson number one, isn't it, really? Anger is not the way. And yet in this, he's getting cross with her because she's not doing as she, you know, he wants her to. But I mean, that's down to him to be a good enough teacher to take her there despite that, you know. So that side of it I thought was really fun. And hopefully that'll, you know, if they layer a lot more of that in there, it could feel like a very realistic character for a change, and somebody with a bit more depth, you know.
Paul, do you guys forget that Kanan is blind in this episode?
Yeah, I did. I mean, yeah. Well, apart from the fact that, like, behaviorally he's not doing anything, that's, you know, it's like, okay, like, after he was blind, that's when the character just kind of vanishes.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you kind of feel like he's just not being treated with the same significance, which seems a bit of a shame, you know. You think, like, well, you know, he could be twice as interesting. I mean, like, you know, there's like a lot of people mentioned Zatoichi, which is a blind swordsman movie that's quite famous, you know, and I think everybody was anticipating that, you know, that's into that sort of stuff, that might be where they might go with him, that they might take him into that kind of area. But right now they haven't really. I mean, they just kind of feel like he's been benched, doesn't it, really? I mean, it seems that way to me anyway. What do you guys think?
I that's exactly how I would categorize it, which is he's been benched. And I thought that the plot, you know, entering blindness into this was going to be a way to show even more strength and growth for the character.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But now he's just the handicapped guy that doesn't really get a whole lot of play.
You know, I think it's interesting, though, the shift in the way the storytelling has happened, where we're almost seeing it from Kanan's perspective. We're seeing the story unfold through the eyes of a blind man. So I don't know if that's intentional, but it certainly appears to be coming off that way to me. And
Is that why he feels that he's on the sidelines? Because you're more or less seeing it through his? Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So I just feel like the series right now is being told more through his perspective, whereas maybe in the first season, two seasons, it was told through Ezra's perspective.
Is anybody else getting a bit confused about the whole kind of Bogan thing about, I mean, he very much kind of feels like he's getting wheeled off stage and wheeled back on stage, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like, kind of, I mean, he seems like somebody of significance.
Like, why was he there? I mean, other than, I mean, she could have, like, she could have just, like, you know, passed gas, and he just kind of turned around and kind of looked like there was no significance other than, like, well, that smells funny.
Right.
Other than the fact,
why is he there? Why is Bendu there? Is something I've been asking ever since his introduction at the beginning of the season. I must be the rare example. Excuse me. I must be the rare example of the Star Wars fan who does not care for the Bendu character.
I really like him, but I just don't get the point. You know, it's like, it just kind of feels a little, it feels so significant. I mean, in part just because of his size, you just think, look at that giant thing with that amazing voice.
That's part and of the reason I don't like him. By the way, I love Tom Baker. I love his voice. I'm he's the Doctor Who I grew up on. But,
yeah, me too.
And I love the fact that he's been brought into Star Wars, but to play a big giant moose is disappointing to me. A big giant moose who lives underground, who pops up every once in a while to lay down some sort of vague philosophical rap, and then he goes back underground. I just don't get it. What is he supposed to represent? The gray area of the Force. I'd much rather see that being represented through a normal character who's on his own sort of hero's journey or whatever.
I've got to take us off a slight tangent while it occurs to me. Did I ever tell you guys about, like, thinking that as a kid I thought Tom Baker was psychic for a day? It's really funny. I actually met him when he was doing a signing Doctor Who books when I was a little kid. I remember going out and seeing him at this book signing, and I'd be like about seven, so it's a long, long time ago, seven or eight. And there he was, and he was like, he was chatting away to me, and he gave me a jelly baby, which was a huge thrill, because that was his thing as Doctor Who, you know, he'd give jelly babies out. And I remember chatting to him, and all of a sudden he said, So you really like the Bionic Man? And I remember just thinking, how does he know? How does he know, right? And then just, this is incredible, he really knows. And then I got home and, you know, went brush my teeth or whatever at night time. And then it occurred to me, I had a Bionic Man badge on, a Bionic Man t-shirt on. I was wearing a little denim suit like the Bionic Man, you know.
Bionic Man.
So, like, there's no way he was going to miss that, you know. But I was like, I was so focused on that's Doctor Who, you know, and I wasn't thinking about what I was wearing. For about 5 minutes, I thought, wow, he's really, like, he's from Gallifrey. This guy has, like, superpowers, you know.
And then he got in his TARDIS and split.
Yeah. So, sorry, I took us into Doctor Who territory there. But, yeah, I guess what I'm getting at is, like, he's awesome. The character seems like a good idea, but, like, it just feels like, yeah, like, wheel it in, wheel it out. You know, I mean, it literally feels like somebody kind of comes in on a trolley on the stage and they just wheel him off when they feel like it, you know. But
true, it does feel that way.
I'm more of it, but I'm just gonna feel like, okay, give us some substance, you know, give us a real concrete.
What did you guys think about this and the idea of Tar Vizsla, the first Mandalorian Jedi, who created the Darksaber? The Darksaber was retired and sort of put in the Jedi Hall of Fame there, and it was later stolen. Kind of like OJ's bust in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So it's stolen. And then, you know, continued to serve as a symbol of, as I say, consolidation of power from House Vizsla. What did you guys think of that idea?
I'm puzzled by the idea of a Mandalorian Jedi, because they are the warrior race. We're to assume that his little bit of history hasn't changed since Pre-Vizsla laid it on us back in the Clone Wars days. Warrior race. True warrior roots. You know, I mean, he's not just blowing smoke there. It had to come from somewhere. I find it fascinating to learn that the Mandalorian system is made up of so many different diverse planets.
Yeah, thousands? That was a surprise. I was like, really?
So, but that gives you a lot of wiggle room where you can have all these different sects of Mandalorian lifestyle, culture, history, what have you. But still, the idea of Tar Vizsla, the Darksaber Jedi, maybe he's from a planet that has pacifist ways, much like what Sabine is promoting in the Clone Wars when she takes over Mandalore. But
I kind of feel like this. I kind of feel like that. I mean, before I say this, I must just preface it by saying, like, I appreciate a bunch of people have commented, I think, including Pablo, rather humorously pointed out that, you know, and the Robot Chicken guys pointed out that, you know, like, if one character delivers pizza in a Star Wars movie, suddenly their entire race is pizza deliverers, you know, that kind of thing. And I think that with Boba Fett, you know, we were brought up with a certain kind of perception of what a Mandalorian was. It went through that filter, you know, we thought they were probably cool and silent and mysterious and, you know, and very much like Boba appeared in the original movies. But now I kind of feel as though, you know, we're developing well outside of that. And we've had many, many years of, you know, looking at various different kind of, you know, Mandalorians and Mandalorian cultures in a way that teaches us much more about Mandalorians, and we kind of know more about who they are and what they are way beyond Boba Fett. But at the same time, I kind of feel that when it feels like Boba for me, you know, you get these kind of silent characters turning up in all the super cool, you know, kind of Joe Johnson gear, or you get, you know, that little like proto Fets and all that. I'm totally into it. Love the look of it. Like, and seeing him on that snowy planet, by the way, was a real thrill too. I liked just the look of it. It just felt really kind of cool. But when they start getting into that warrior race thing, you know, I kind of feel like they're only an inch away from Klingons. And for me, you know, that to me would be a real simplification of the Mandos if that's kind of pushed much more. It kind of feels like, okay, we get that you're kind of warriors, but like, I don't feel like they need to have a philosophy that's quite so vocally obsessed with that, you know, like, you know, that was one of the things that kind of made Klingons a little boring after a while, was because they were all constantly, you know, this is not how a warrior eats dinner, you know, why does everything have to be about whether you're a warrior or not, you know, like, it's like, can we just kind of get by that? And like with Mandos, I kind of feel like they could go that way, you know, it's like warrior this, warrior that, it's like,
well, it sure seemed like they were going in that direction during the Karen Travis era when she was writing the Mando books, and they were they developed the language and all of that stuff, and then you saw fandom start to respond in kind. So definitely, but you know, and I don't knock that at all. I don't knock people who walk around speaking Klingon. I think that's a lot of fun and a great way to immerse yourself and be very interactive with the franchise you're a fan of. I'm not knocking that, but as far as storytelling goes, it does get to be a little predictable, doesn't it?
It can do, yeah. I mean, and I like the idea of them being something a bit more complicated than that, you know. And it's like, I appreciate that, you know, you're kind of dealing with those kind of tropes. So you can have a bit of samurai in there and Bushido. You can have a little bit of, you know, Viking or, you know, whatever, you know, honor codes and all that kind of stuff. So I get that they're pulling from lots of different sources. I just think it would be nice if it sort of stayed away from going the Klingon route too much, you know, with a kind of, worry this and worry that.
But I mean, that is what we know about the Mandalores too.
Yeah.
That is what we know about them. And we certainly know that anyone who is part of their army or military, whatever you want to call it, you know, that it's about fighting the fight. And, you know, Yoda's the one who said wars do not make a Jedi great. And, you know, he scoffed at the usage of the word warrior. He scoffed at
I always thought that there was an element of the, I mean, you know, obviously we kind of know better now, but I always kind of felt as though there was almost a touch of the Predators about them, you know, as well, that kind of, you know, the need to get the kill and all that kind of stuff, you know, it kind of, you know, that felt like, I don't know, a slightly richer and less kind of, a less used kind of trope, you know. You kind of feel like, oh yeah, this is something that goes beyond like the cult of the warrior. It becomes about, you know, kind of needing to achieve what you said you'd achieve and things like that, you know, which kind of makes it a little bit richer and a bit more kind of, you know, that could be anything. It doesn't necessarily need to be kill. It could be, you know, we promised this and so we're gonna stick to that promise, you know, or I don't know. I'm nitpicking.
Jason, do you have anything to say about the Jedi Mandalore or anything like that? The dark saber?
Not so much. I'll tell you what I actually thought was kind of cool was when Fenn Rau delivers the gauntlets and he reveals that those gauntlets that we've seen, you know, in use were actually designed to combat Jedi. And I thought that was really cool. So when you see Boba Fett shooting that rope around Luke on the skiff and Jedi, it's like, that was designed to do that to a Jedi wielding a lightsaber. So I really thought that was fun.
I love that moment when you saw the jump off the ship initially as well. You know, when the two guys were on the jetpacks, just kind of diving off the ship as it went down and stuff. That was one of those moments where you just kind of go, "Oh man, kid me would have just gone crazy for that." I'm sure I would have been jumping up and down at the TV. You know.
Now there was a revelation about lightsabers in this episode that I found fascinating, and I don't think it's ever been put out there in black and white. But as Kanan is initially training Sabine on how to spar and duel, he says that the blades of the sabers will be drawn to each other, which I found like there's almost a magnetic pull between lightsaber blades, which I found fascinating, because there are times, especially in the prequels, where you sort of see like Yoda fighting with Dooku and all of a sudden, you know, the sabers will just kind of connect and stay connected. Mm-hmm. And I always was like, wow, that it almost appears there's a magnetic quality between the blades. And this is the first time, at least as far as hard, solid canon goes, that we're getting an explanation for this. I don't know. There could be some other explanation for it out there, but I've never heard that one before.
I wonder if that's a George thing, you know? You would think it would have to be, wouldn't you? It feels like, you know...
It could
be. I'd love to, you know, what all of this kind of like does make me kind of think is you know, it's almost as soon as we know that George has something to do with any of this stuff, you know, we do have a tendency to kind of like suddenly treat it as something of more significance and something that deserves a bit more respect automatically just as a result. You know, it feels like it's definitely authentic Star Wars and what have you. And with Dave having such a close relationship with George creatively and you know, he feels as close as we can get to that at this stage. But whenever I look at something like this, I always kind of think like, what I really, really want is that I want Dave and George to sit down and just talk about the big picture for like 4 hours, you know. I'd like to know what an interview. Yeah, what George's kind of perspective is on the bigger picture. And I know we all know the basics. We all know, you know, the stuff that we've picked up from the movies and all these years of watching stuff about them and everything else. But it would be really great to just get a proper like look inside George's head when it comes to all the stuff that we're not exploring. Like, why are we not going to find out about Yoda's species? What is the reason? You know, what like, you know, are the you know, how old is the Jedi Order and like what came before the Jedi Order and, you know, how old is the Force and all these? I mean, there are billions of questions that I'm sure that George could actually answer, because there's no intention for him to kind of like go there. But then at the same time, we do kind of wonder, I mean, how much of that stuff has George actually thought through, and how much of it is on the fly, you know, how much kind of comes to him as he goes, you know, it's I mean, maybe there's not as much floating around inside his head about this as we expect. But I mean, at the same time, when he was like very creatively involved, you do kind of feel like he always had an opinion about things. So clearly the world is, you know, it was much bigger to George than we were aware of until it sort of showing up in Rebels and Clone Wars. So I don't know. I just want more of, you know, tell me what George's idea was for the sequel trilogy. I want to know, you know, how it differs. I want to know, you know, what, you know, what he really feels internally about the whole kind of thing. I don't feel like we've got the whole picture yet, you know, do you?
Yeah, I think that we're always going to, for our generation, and even, you know, a couple of the advancing generations, I think there's always going to be that big question hanging over us, especially why George is, you know, still among the living, is what would George do? You know, what would George think?
Yeah.
That's sort of a test on, you know, is it really Star Wars? Does it feel like Star Wars? Could we see George doing it? And I think that, you know, eventually it's going to get to that point where it won't be that way. It'll just be Star Wars. But right now it does feel like there's, in some ways, there's the George Lucas era and there's the post Lucas era. And, you know, I think they do a really good job most of the time making it feel very fluid as if it's one thing. But there are a few occasions when it seems to veer off. And I think that, you know, you see most of that in the tie-in material. Dave, certainly, we're very fortunate, I think, to have Dave there at the helm still of Lucas Animation, in the sense that I think he can course correct, and if things get too, you know, crazy, he's a sense of, you know, true north, and that true north is kind of still built around George's ideas. I hope that we'd never lose that. I really think that we need to keep that touchstone there. You know, yeah. My feeling is do whatever you want in the comic books, do whatever you want in the novels. But if it's on the screen, please, outside of the Lego stuff, maybe, where that's all about fun, please keep it true. You know, the very end, I want to say, I feel like that Ezra really got dissed. You know, you talk about the medal for Chewie. Where was the hug for Ezra? He's been crushing on that poor girl for years. And she, you know, hugs Kanan. Like, he gets...
Boy, kid.
Yeah. I mean, you don't
the even... Boy, what was your name? Boy. What?
Yeah, there was like nothing. It was...
Why blue kid?
It was a bit of a... Her leaving was a bit of a non-event.
I've got a question for you. If Sabine was supposedly kind of working on some, you know, secret imperial, like, evil thing, whatever, of some description, some weapons or whatever, do any of you guys think that... Is it called Cronest, the island that they're on, or Cronest, or something like that?
Cronus.
Is Cronus going to turn out to be Starkiller Base? That's the thing I was wondering, because it just looked just like, you know, the same planet. You know,
it was
very wintry, wasn't it? Right? You know, the little forests and, you know.
When she crash landed the Phantom, I was thinking to myself,
right?
Boy, this looks like Han and Chewie landing the Millennium Falcon in The Force Awakens. Definitely. Wow. I totally see where you're coming from.
What did you guys think about the Ren family? We learned that it's actually the mother that is of, you know, more, I don't want to say royal, I don't think that's the right term, but is of the bloodline, I guess, for the House of Vizsla. The father is not. The father is, you don't really, I don't think you get a true sense of what's going on with him other than that he is in the possession of the Empire, working for the Empire, or factions of Mandalore that are sympathetic to the Empire.
And so we've started on the next episode, and you didn't give any of the stats or anything like that. I just
what?
You didn't give all the proper stats for the.
I thought we've been on the next episode, haven't we?
Yeah.
No, not officially, not without the stats.
All right, fine. We'll definitely give you the tail of the tape here. What is this? Is this episode 16? My screen just went blank. Yeah,
it is.
It's episode 16, written by Christopher Yost and directed by Mel Zweier. Yes, we are now officially talking about Legacy of Mandalore. This fairly did feel like one big episode, though. It really
did. Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was one solid arc. As a matter of fact, I'd like to point out, you know, we did mention that we felt like some of the plot for Warhead was a little thin, and it's revealed on StarWars.com that Warhead and Trials of the Darksaber were actually, the events of those episodes were all supposed to happen together in one episode, but they split off the two different subplots to their own episodes. So that's maybe why we felt like Warhead... Which was a little thin on story.
It was really supposed to be a side plot.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, that's it.
You know, I know that, you know, obviously, you know, racing Star Wars is kind of like a moot point, really, in a way, in that, you know, you've got obviously kind of, you know, a lot of the clones look like New Zealanders, you know, and you've got a lot of the imps look like English people, you know. Things like that. So it's all kind of all over the map, really. I mean, it's like anybody's guess what kind of nationality inspired a lot of the different cultures. And you've even got, you know, French people as the Twi'leks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize that Sabine's family were going to look, they almost look Japanese or something, don't they? Or like mixed race of you know, I kind of had it tied down as a pretty kind of like ordinary kind of base character, but like it seems like maybe maybe even just an unusual looking Mandalorian, because, you know, most of them look quite kind of Aryan, don't they, kind of like blonde blue eyes and stuff like that. So I didn't really anticipate that our family would look the way they looked, you know.
Yeah, I
thought
I didn't
it was kind of cool, interesting, but I'm not really sure where that came from, you know. It's like, oh, okay,
you know, I wonder if they sort of deconstructed, if they would, you know, if you take the purple hair off of Sabine, you know, if and put her with, you know, dark hair and maybe traditional, more traditional garb.
We saw her that way earlier like this season. Yeah, we saw her that way earlier this season, if you remember, when she went undercover to bust out Wedge and Hobby. She went undercover as an Imperial officer.
Maybe she's adopted, I don't know.
And had dark hair.
But yeah, I thought that I didn't see a lot of continuity between the look of the mother and the brother, who definitely looked similar, and Sabine. Mm. Now, that also could have been, you know, a design choice to illustrate her separation a bit.
Yeah.
You know, mm. So who knows? But yeah, there was definitely sort of an ethnic quality to them that I didn't see carried through into Sabine. The mom, mm. you know, she, you know, her story here, where she's willing to give up. You know, first of all, we know now in Star Wars, you never try to make a deal with the Empire. Lando figured that out. Now you got mom, you know, trying to make a deal. And, you know, the guy's like, oh, no, we'll make sure that, you know, she's taken care of. Wink, wink, nod, nod. So it's no surprise that when he shows up, his name is escaping me. Who's the Mandalorian?
Gar Saxon.
Gar Saxon. Mm. Right. I went to school with a Ricky Saxon.
No yeah,
maybe, yeah.
Well, maybe they are related.
Could be. They have similar hair. Similar hair. So Gar Saxon shows up, and he's having none of it. He's going to take control there. And, you know, at the time, it seemed like he was at least willing to give, what is it, Ursula? Is that the mom?
Ursa Wren.
I was thinking Ursula. But he's willing to give her a pass so long as he can take Sabine. And she's, of course, having, you know, mom decides that family means more. She was choosing politics and the opportunity of saving the name or you know, increasing the status that's already been blown by Sabine. She was sort of trading it up, but not at the sacrifice of her daughter's life. So when it looks like it's coming down between that, you know, she chooses to. I mean, she gave up the Jedi very quickly. That's for sure.
Hmm.
I didn't think there was any. There was sort of this kind of like weird moment where, you know, she talks to Gar Saxon, and then she's in her chamber. She's talking to the Jedi, and I don't even remember what it exactly is that they say to her. And she's like, "Oh, well, that settles that." The guns, the blasters are drawn, and here comes Gar Saxon. So I think she had the intention to betray the Jedi from. You know, day one, I don't think there was ever a, well, it depends on how they answer this next question as to whether or not I'm going to give them up.
I got to say, on a shallow note, I loved all the Rennie McIntosh stuff. You know, I love the design of the place. It looked gorgeous. I loved all the architecture. Did you guys notice one of the interiors was identical to one of the areas in Big Rock?
We saw her that way earlier like this season. Yeah, we saw her that way earlier this season, if you remember, when she went undercover to bust out Wedge Hobby.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
When she bust out Wedge and Hobby, she went undercover as an Imperial officer.
Maybe she's adopted. I don't know.
And had dark hair.
Mm. Yeah. But yeah, I thought that I didn't see a lot of continuity between the look of the mother and the brother, who definitely looked similar, and Sabine. Now, that also could have been, you know, a design choice to illustrate her separation a bit. Yeah. You know, so who knows? But yeah, there was definitely sort of an ethnic quality to them that I didn't see carried through into Sabine. The mom, you know, she. You know, her story here, where she's willing to give up. You know, first of all, we know now in Star Wars, you never try to make a deal with the Empire. Lando figured that out. Now you got mom, you know, trying to make a deal. And, you know, the guy's like, oh, no, we'll make sure that, you know, she's taken care of. Wink, wink, nod, nod. So it's no surprise that when he shows up, his name is escaping me. Who's the Mandalorian?
Gar Saxon.
Right. I went to school with a Ricky Saxon.
Yeah.
No relation. Yeah.
Well, maybe they are related. But
could be. Yeah. They have similar hair. Similar hair. So Gar Saxon shows up, and he's having none of it. He's going to take control there. And, you know, at the time, it seemed like he was at least willing to give, what is it, Ursula? Is that the mom?
Ursa Wren.
I was thinking Ursula. But he's willing to give her a pass so long as he can take Sabine, and she's, of course, having, you know, mom decides that family means more. She was choosing politics and the opportunity of saving the name or you know, increasing the status that's already been blown by Sabine. She was sort of trading it up, but not at the sacrifice of her daughter's life. So when it looks like it's coming down between that, you know, she chooses to, I mean, she gave up the Jedi very quickly. That's for sure.
Mm.
I didn't think there was any
there was sort of this kind of like weird moment where, you know, she talks to Gar Saxon, and then she's in her chamber. She's talking to the Jedi, and I don't even remember what it exactly is that they say to her. And she's like, "Oh, well, that settles that. The guns, the blasters are drawn, and here comes Gar Saxon." So I think she had the intention to betray the Jedi from, you know, day one. I don't think there was ever a, well, it depends on how they answer this next question as to whether or not I'm going to give them up.
I gotta say, on a shallow note, I loved all the Rennie McIntosh stuff. You know, I love the design of the place. It looked gorgeous. I loved all the architecture. Did you guys notice one of the interiors was identical to the one of the areas in Big Rock?
Yeah, as a matter of fact,
you know, Tracy, where the fire is.
Yes, Tracy Canobio actually tweeted that out this morning, and if you take a look at it, it looks exactly like Big Rock.
Yeah, right. Like down where the window is, where you can see out onto the lake and everything.
Right,
yeah.
With the big long table and everything. So
yeah, really cool.
Now home of Skywalker Vineyards. No longer home to Lucasfilm Animation. Yeah.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, well, I think that's what they call all of the properties now. I think they're all sort of being officially referred to as Skywalker Vineyards. But I know I know that that's like what they call Big Rock now. And I think Lucas's educational institution. They all work out of there as well.
So what do you guys think here? We leave Sabine on Cronus. Is this removing her? I mean, are they? Is this part of the paring down process as we lead into
what about the rumors?
Galactic struggle.
What about the rumors flying around on the internet this week saying that season 4 is not confirmed? And people point out, well, if you look back to 2015, November 2015 is when they made the announcement that season 3 is coming, when they confirmed season 3. Now, here we are all the way mid-February. We have not received confirmation of season 4, and we're seeing characters now, maybe, especially in the case of Sabine, perhaps come to the end of their Rebels story arc. When can we expect to see Sabine again? She certainly is not going to be a regular featured character on the show moving forward. They're not going to stick around Mandalore. We've already seen in previews that they're going to be going elsewhere, like Tatooine, for example. Do we expect to even see Sabine return in season 3 of Rebels? I say no. I think we've seen the end of her story arc, maybe even permanently for Rebels. Perhaps.
Really?
If there is no season 4. There is no season 4.
I kind of feel as though the setup is definitely that we're expecting a big finale to this show. And I think that if season 4 does come along, then Sabine is going to be part of that payoff. They need to kind of give us a big, like, hooray ending, don't they? And I think we're going to get that Han Solo returns to kind of save the day situation, where all the kind of extraneous characters, all the secondary characters that have been shown to be part of the Rebellion's earliest days, will suddenly all kind of gather in this, you know, this congruence of heroes, if you like. And I think that the finale of this is going to be all these different characters coming together, and I'm sure Sabine will be among them. I think that's probably what we can expect. They're kind of maybe writing her out to sort of, you know, give something of have a character of impact kind of come back, you know. But I don't know. That's what I would do with it. But I mean, I don't get a feeling that they are going to call it a day in season 3. It doesn't feel likely to me. I mean, I kind of feel like there'd be more of a vibe that was going to go down. Don't you, Jimmy? You think we'd have more of an idea that there'd probably be rumors about, at least I would have thought, if that was going to happen. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, everybody kind of, you know, saw the kind of Clone Wars thing come in a little bit, at least. But right now, I mean, I think there's only been a handful of episodes away from the end of season 3. I think if season 4 was a no-no, I think we'd probably know by now, wouldn't you?
Well, I haven't heard anything. And that's what makes me more nervous than anything. And remember, with the Clone Wars, we started yelling and screaming about the Clone Wars long before an announcement was made. And that was our famous "the sky is falling" moment. I'm not prepared to start yelling and screaming "the sky is falling," especially in the light of the fact that there are some fresh Filoni interviews out there where he's not he's not closing the door shut on season four. He's not necessarily holding it wide open either. I think that there could be a spinoff in the works that may take a character like Sabine, spin her off into her own show. Sabine of Mandalore. I would not put faith in a series that was solely helmed by the character of Sabine just because of the fact that I haven't had that connection with her. But it could be. It could be.
I think from a kind of just a commercial kind of, you know, animation standpoint, I think it's quite likely that they'll move into the territory where they can cross pollinate. I think that, you know, where they'll move closer to the current era of movies to a lesser, you know, or greater degree. But I think at some point we're going to end up with films that contain stuff like, you know, BB-8 style droids, or, you know, or the New Order rather than the Empire, or, you know, whatever it is. I think they'll push it closer to the movies so they can, you know, they can, I mean, to be cynical about it, they can sell more toys. But on a more, you know, positive way of looking at it, just, you know, they can make a closer connection with kids that are already kind of dialed into that. You know, they kind of love the movies and they love certain things in the films, you know, and that they're going to have all that advertising revenue and all that promotion and stuff going into that, you know, that they can kind of feed off if they've got a show that is kind of closer to it. Whereas, you know, something like Rebels, sure, you know, we can kind of hook up with something like Rogue One in small ways. And I suspect we're going to get, you know, even more hooked into it now going forward. But I think it would make a lot of sense for them to kind of like shift into that territory. And I think being as Dave has clearly kind of moved on to something new, you know, I kind of feel as though there would probably be a longer gap between kind of Dave's departure and the start of a new show than we have right now. So my feeling is that I think season four, you know, it makes sense that Dave would need a, you know, 2 or 3 years to kind of like really get something in ship shape to kind of wheel out a successor. Now, I'm sure that's kind of what's likely to be going down right now. So I think we're probably going to get season four, and then, you know, there'll be an announcement once that's done that, you know, what we're getting next. But there's no way they aren't keeping Dave as busy as he's always been. You know, we all know his value, and I'm sure that the company knows his value, and I'm sure they'll be making great use of him right now, and that we're not necessarily kind of aware of what he's up to. I don't.
Well, he's certainly busy on this episode. Storyboard artist, producer, writer. I mean, he's done it all over there. Mm-hmm. So
that was really a while ago.
Yeah, it was a year ago. I mean, really, when you look at the way that these shows get produced, if this is
the Sabine swan song, why? Why get rid of her?
Because she's bored as anything, and all she does is tag stuff and be annoying. That's it. Sorry. She's only appealing if you're like six, you know?
Hey, did you guys find it interesting?
That's a really spin statement, was that? I'm sorry, I don't mean.
In the Trials of the Darksaber episode, when Sabine approached Kanan and they were going to resolve their issues, Kanan says, "I owe you an apology." Sabine says, "I can say the same." But neither of them says, "I'm sorry."
Yeah.
"I owe you an apology. Okay, then pay up. I can say the same, but I'm not gonna."
Yeah.
Well, that's going to put a wrap on our triple header this week, looking at the past three episodes of Star Wars Rebels. And we're so glad that you were here for us. And what a great conversation this was. I certainly enjoyed our conversation about Warhead more than I enjoyed the episode itself, to be truthful about it. But I also, I love the fact that we get this opportunity to sort of break these things down and just chat them through, because then I go back and I can look at the episode with a new pair of eyes. This one, it leaves me with the big question of what is the future of Sabine, and if her future is now just going to be told in perhaps comics and novelizations and maybe junior novels or whatever. Why get rid of this character? Is this a paring down? Is this a focusing?
Is the series wrapping up? Is the series wrapping up? Is the series
wrapping up? Yeah. And I think, Jim, you're more on the side of that. I think you're starting to feel that this could be it.
Yes, I am feeling like season three. I would not be surprised if we start seeing advertising for the season finale in terms of calling it the series finale.
Mm.
Wow, you think?
I just said it.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out in the days and weeks to come. This was episode 16. I think we're going to go for a whole 23 or 24. So I'm guessing we have 6 to 8 more episodes that may have already been revealed. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but typical season here in the States would be 22 episodes. Animated series, sometimes we've seen, I think we've seen as many as 24 in a season. We'll find out. Paul, thanks so much for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, man. I mean, Rebels has still got room to kind of grow, I think. You know, I just hope it grows fast, because I think whether we get, like, you know, the end of this season and another season, or we just get this season. Anyway, look at it, I don't kind of feel like we've got enough room to really kind of get the most out of these characters. I still think they've got a lot of space to kind of, you know, show us more about who these characters are and where they're going. And you know, as much as I kind of knock it, you know, I want more of these guys. I want to know more about them. I want to see more to do with them, and I want to see more of their world. And I really hope that Thrawn starts to play a bigger part than just kind of wheeling in and going, my plan is going great. You know, like
I love this analogy that you've drawn of wheeling these characters in, because it's so visual and yet so true. It's how it feels. I can almost hear the squeaks of the wheel, of the wheels. Yeah, slowly, of course. Pull on that Bendu. Anyway, awesome talking to you, Paul. Jimmy Mack, your final thoughts here on these three episodes and perhaps the state of Rebels now.
Well, you know, I'll keep my final thoughts to let's just call them additional comments, because I don't feel like we really gave the third episode of this triple play its due. I think there were some important things we left out, most notably Sabine. Her mother said she has no real claim to the Darksaber because she just took it. She didn't actually earn it. She just grabbed it for herself and thought that gave her immediate power. So maybe that's a commentary on how millennials act these days. I don't know. But that was a joke. I'll accept a butt kicking from our younger fans on social media. Because that's what they do anyway.
You got to watch it now, Jimmy. They're all in charge.
I know. I'm shaking in my boots. But Sabine, also the revelations made in Rebels Recon about the way Gar Saxon rose to power on the planet Mandalore. I find a lot of contradictions in the explanations from Lucasfilm about the status of the Mandalore system. At one point, they're saying that the Empire has taken over the system and they appointed Gar Saxon in charge. And through him, he wields the power of the Empire. But yet they state when Ursa Wren kills Gar Saxon, this creates a void needs to be filled. But if the Empire is truly oppressing the system, wouldn't they just put someone else in charge? What changes? Wouldn't they just wheel in a Star Destroyer, drop someone else off, and start fresh? I understand 1,000 planets in a system is hard to control if you're this dominant, powerful, oppressive Empire. You only have so many Star Destroyers. But if they truly do have control of the system, that shouldn't be a problem for the Empire we know and love. So I found that very interesting that they say that it's going to throw the system into civil war again. But and on the other side of the coin, they're saying the Empire is in charge of the system. So what is it? It doesn't sound like that's actually been truly defined, because
it might be harder for the Empire to install another puppet in there once so many have witnessed the death of Gar Saxon. Perhaps that is what creates the void, because they, you know, take that stuff obviously very seriously when it comes to a, you know, a character like that, or a figure like dying at the hands of someone else.
Okay. Oh, good. More music, because I have more things to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, I got more music.
So, maybe they're just all out of trolleys. They might just have no more trolleys left, and they think we can't bring anybody else in because
no more squeaky wheels.
Perhaps it's a war that the Empire is orchestrating. We certainly know they're very good at orchestrating civil war. So maybe they're trying to cleanse the system somehow, and they figure let's just let them fight it out, and then we'll assert our oppressive government into place afterwards. You know, maybe that's the way they're looking at it. Maybe they think if there's civil war in the Mandalore system, it'll just weaken the system and make them much more subservient to Imperial control. So I kind of came to a conclusion on that. I'm very happy with. Call the story group. Get Leland Chi on the phone. Also, I found it interesting, the connection that Sabine had to the Darksaber and her ability to wield it and, you know, feel that connection where she starts saying, it feels lighter. It's, you know, things like that. That's like a Jedi connection to a lightsaber and something that I've always considered sacred within Star Wars. So when Sabine started making that connection to the Darksaber, I just wrote it off and said, well, maybe it's something about her Mandalorian blood that gives her a connection to this saber. And it's the Force guiding it. Maybe not the Force coming from her, but the Force coming from the blade itself. So it puzzles me.
The Force is in all of us. I think that's what they were trying
to say. Yes, I get that. Because then you see her use Ezra's green bladed saber to fight Gar Saxon at the end, and she wields it with expert and ease. So so it has to be more of a connection to the Force than to anything Mandalorian, opinion. Do I think that Sabine is strong in the Force? I still don't. I don't see them developing the character that way, but maybe they will. Maybe she's going to be the last Jedi. Who knows?
You know, for all that I'm kind of, you know, being sort of flippant about wheeling characters on and off, I mean, it's a genuine concern to me. You know, I just think, like, what they seem to be doing quite a lot of is like, okay, well, you know, you know, give them a break, and like I said before, it's only a 20-minute show, so how much can they really achieve in 20 minutes and still tell a story that's new and interesting? But at the same time, they're kind of the arc parts of the story, the whole idea that, you know, that you've got a character who potentially has a potential to turn to the dark side, you know, the fact that we've been hinting at that for Ezra, and then they'll put it on a shelf for a few weeks where it's just not even an issue. You know, and then, like, you know, eventually they'll get around to the Ezra story and that'll suddenly jump to the fore again. But you do kind of feel like that they are literally kind of moving things in and out of, like, reality. You know, you kind of feel like, okay, this matters right now, and then next week it doesn't matter. And that's when I start to lose interest, just purely because I kind of feel like, you know, it needs to feel real, and for it to feel real, it has to feel kind of consistent, you know?
Yeah. As Star Wars fans, I think we're very resistant to disposable storylines or concepts that just get completely thrown away and inconsistency comes into play. And I don't know. I don't fear that Star Wars storytelling is going in that direction. But, so I'm ready to sign off here, guys, but I've run into a conundrum. On StarWars.com, it was revealed that within Sabine's quarters, she's added some new graffiti, including that of a puffer pig. So if Sabine's, if Sabine's quarters are featured in the show, I can't say my famous sign off line. But let's just keep it the flesh and blood. So I think it's safe to say Puffa Pig, not in this episode.
You know, I really want to believe that was a response to this show. I really do. Why else the Puffa Pig? Oh, my gosh. All right. We'll see you next time. For Rebel Force Radio, I'm Jason.
And I'm Jimmy Mack.
And remember,
the Force will be with you always.